This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3665, for Friday, the 19th of August, 2022. Today's show is entitled, Unix is Sublime. It is hosted by BinRC, and is about 60 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is I talk about all of the reasons I love Unix.
This is my Unix episode. It's more so not necessarily implementation, but some of the designs of a Unix operating system that make it sort of a sublime experience to use and to think about. I also have a couple subtitles I was thinking of as I was writing. The first one is how to use a computer without hating yourself for it in the morning. The next one is Unix is basically a simple operating system, followed by ellipses, because it's not super simple compared to real simple operating systems, but it's pretty close. My third subtitle, my weariness and disdain for computers grows with each additional unit of knowledge. And then my final subtitle is worse is better. So where did Unix come from? Unix is not Multics. Unix is a pun on the Multics name. Multics is, it might be a thing. I've never used Multics. I've never heard of anyone in 2022 using Multics. But Multics was too big, and complicated. So the Bell Labs boys said, let's make something better that's smaller, simpler, easier to use, easier to maintain. And that's sort of the idea, right? Unix is supposed to be simple. I found some cool links. The first one's how to emulate Multics in 2022. I have no idea what's going on in Multics. I couldn't figure it out. I emulated Unix version 5 and Unix version 7, and then there is like a computer history museum, and you can access some of these older systems using SSH guest accounts. And sort of the idea in my head as I was playing with these things is cool but useless. A lot of the stuff that's older is cool, but it's not really useful. Again, I don't know anything about Multics. I don't know if I should even learn it. It doesn't really seem useful, and it's not really interesting to me immediately because it's very complicated and alien feeling. Let's talk about the implementation of Unix. So when I think of Unix, I don't think of like the trademark philosophy. I think about design principles, user interface, and sort of how a Unix system behaves. I usually think POSIX-like is similar to Unix-like. And my example here is that Linux and GNU are not really Unix-like in the sense that they don't really follow the Unix philosophy of make simple things that work together. But I think they pass the duck test. The duck test is if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, and acts like a duck, it's a duck. So for all intents and purposes, Linux is a Unix. Even though when you get under the hood, it becomes difficult. And also when I say Unix, I don't mean proprietary. I mean free Unix-like operating systems. Because a lot of the additional aspects aside from the design that make Unix such a pleasant thing to use is the fact that it's hackable. And you can't really hack a proprietary operating system. I mean, you can, but it doesn't work, and it bricks your MacBook or whatever. So, I mean, open source Unixes or public source things that you can look into, modify, even if you're violating some weird licensing terms, you know, it's not enforced hardly ever as long as you don't tell people about it. You know, if you can hack on it, it's something that I'm interested in. Of course, hacker in the traditional sense, not in the stealing people's credit card numbers and social security numbers and selling them online sense. So what is the Unix philosophy? There's, you know, different people have said different things, but it pretty much boils down to do one thing and do it well, design programs that work together using text as the common interface, test early, test often. And the fourth one is the KISS philosophy. Keep it simple, stupid. And then another design philosophy is everything is a file or process. It sort of boils down into, you know, Unix is a simple operating system, and sometimes worse is better. A complicated solution isn't very useful because nobody can maintain it but the original author, whereas, I guess, a less clever function, a simpler function, using less weird, I guess it would be like standard library hacks, is a better solution. Even though it's objectively worse, it might be slower. If someone can read the solution, I guess the source code to the program, right? The program that is the solution to our problem, and understand it, that is a better solution. That's sort of the Unix philosophy. And I think this show, I'm not going to go into specifics, super specifics, like I said, but I'll talk about like 10,000 foot view. So the design. Unix is a multi-user time-sharing networked operating system. It runs as an always online service. So traditionally, a Unix system is a single mainframe computer, and users connect to it concurrently through dumb terminals. And the dumb terminals have, like, you know, no processing power or just enough processing power to draw your X windows or whatever you have. So what this means is time sharing. The users take turns using system resources. And this sort of design makes actually a lot of sense, because when you think about how people actually use computers, they typically will spawn a process or series of processes that spin up the CPU in a series of short bursts. So if you get multiple people on the same computer, you're actually making better use of your hardware, so you can save money on sort of hardware costs, maintenance costs, because you're only maintaining one thing, power, so on and so forth. I think this is something I would like to see more in the modern era, is sort of the concept of mainframe computing, as opposed to walking into an office and having hundreds of ultra small form factor Windows PCs that are all individually full of viruses and unmaintained and sort of breaking in their own ways. It seems like, at least for me and my perspective, it seems kind of asinine that you would essentially give each user more processing power than they'll ever use, and more opportunity to destroy things and cost the company money than they should be allowed to. And this is not necessarily restricting the freedom of users argument, it's more so from a pragmatic standpoint. It's a lot easier to manage a single system than it is to try to manage hundreds, especially when 99% of the time those like ultra small form factor Windows jet engine sounding things that are about to explode they seem really unnecessary, especially when everyone's just doing data entry in a web browser anyway. Like, that's really what it is data entry and a web browser. And really, that could all be accomplished on a mainframe. I think, you know, tangents aside, let's continue. The actual software running on the mainframe, I visualize it in sort of hierarchical structures. Unix is flexible, but it's organized. And sort of each concept builds upon the concept above it. So if you know anything about computers, you know that the very lowest levels of the hardware on top of that is the kernel, which provides system calls that allow you to write kernel modules and drivers, which enable file systems. On top of file systems, you kind of have the organization starts to break down as now you have a foundation, right? You have system daemons, which are services, users, shells, and then on top of shells, you have user applications. And sort of all of these things culminate together for the sole purpose of enabling the end user to play video games and watch videos. And that's what 50 years of Unix has gotten us. That's the end goal. So I'm going to start from the bottom, explain some of these concepts, and verbosity will ensue. So the very lowest level, we're ignoring the hardware. The kernel, you don't hardly ever interact with it directly. All of the hard parts of writing software and using the system are abstracted. So it's not like when you're on a Commodore 64 and you have to poke a memory address to load a program from tape. You just type the name of the program you want to run, and the kernel just does it. The next aspect, the kernel enables multitasking. So this is resource sharing. This is necessary for multiple users. So when a user starts a process, the process is, hey, kernel, give me CPU time. Give me a turn on the CPU. And each user process is, the way I think of it, is put into a rotational queue. All of the other users' processes and system processes are put into this queue. A lot of times there can be like a round robin approach in the current era. Typically it's weighted. So like a kernel process will always have priority over a user's process. And additionally, when you have multiple users, you can assign them hard limits, so or I guess levels of, you know, if a process is owned by this user, take it before any other user, right? That's what the root account is. So this sort of idea helps prevent system crashes. In addition to time sharing, because when the root user needs to log in and fix something, the root user gets priority over some guy running a fork bomb, for example. Another kernel thing, virtual memory. So abstracting memory management. This makes multitasking almost possible, because instead of each program directly asking the hardware for memory, like in a more primitive operating system. Primitive might be the wrong word, but I'm going to use it anyway because it's funny to call DOS primitive. Sort of the idea is that the kernel manages all of the memory and the end user doesn't have to touch memory ever, ever, ever. The other thing about virtual memory is that you don't actually have to have physical RAM. You can have a swap partition, which functions as RAM, in air quotes, kind of, not really, but kind of. You can also, if you're really, really making a bad decision, you can mount a cloud provider's disk as swap, and then all of your passwords get submitted to your cloud provider, because that's where passwords are stored, is in RAM, and your Lux key for your hard disk encryption is submitted to your cloud provider, and so on and so forth. Actually, an interesting thing about virtual memory. So virtual memory enabled me to run Gen 2, very heavy Gen 2 installation on a system with 4 gigabytes of RAM, because I had 16 gigabytes of swap space. So functionally, although it was destroying the hard drive with each additional compilation job, that functionally gave me 20 gigabytes of memory for, you know, compiling large things like Firefox. And sort of the idea behind virtual memory and swap space is that the kernel doesn't panic when it runs out of memory. So this means non-essential processes can be killed or sent to swap, or even idle processes. Typically, idle processes are automatically sent to swap after they've been idle for so long. But what the idea of swap space means is you can push your system a little bit farther than it probably would with a different operating system if you're using Unix, because you have this buffer of virtual memory. So that means, hypothetically, you have 16 gigabytes of RAM, and you should probably have 24 gigs of swap, because 1.5 times memory is about how much swap you should use. So you can suspend, and then also have, what this means, having the ability to do virtual memory, it means when you push your system too far, it's able to recover without crashing. Typically, you don't even notice, which is kind of cool. Whereas a non-Unix system or a system without virtual memory, it crashes every time you push it a little bit too far. It's not forgiving. And I think forgiveness is kind of important in operating systems, especially when we do ridiculous things as end users, or we make mistakes. Or for example, we copy and paste the fork bomb, and instead of crashing the whole system as a non-privileged user, the kernel just kills the fork bomb process, and the system continues to run. And then eventually it will recover as it clears up memory. Another interesting thing is paged memory, which is sort of logical memory. It's kind of like logical disk management, or like Linux LVM, logical volume management. So paged memory is really cool. Instead of allocating memory, so when a program starts, it requests memory, and instead of allocating memory in a continuous block, or a continuous chunk, so say your program asks for, it's a big program, it asks for 2 gigabytes of memory, it's going to get exactly 2 gigabytes, exactly in line. And when the program swaps out, that whole 2 gigabytes has to go out, in or out, all at once. This doesn't really allow for a lot of flexibility. But what page memory is it slices up the available memory into smaller slices. You know, it depends on what kernel configurations you're running, what implementations of page memory you're running. But what page memory does is, instead of allocating you one continuous chunk, when your operating system first starts, it'll probably be one continuous chunk, but as it's running for longer, the memory becomes fragmented. So when you have your big, 2 gigabyte web browser in memory, instead of swapping out the entire thing, if written appropriately, it can swap out specific pages which contain tabs. So the example here is not stalling your web browser by swapping out unused tabs to disk. And sort of the idea behind page memory is that you don't have to allocate things exactly directly in continuous chunks of memory. And having the kernel do this means the end programmer doesn't even realize, what's going on. So when you're writing C, you're incrementing along memory on a pointer. You might be going to all sorts of different places in memory, but to you or to the program, you're just going along incrementally, and the kernel does all of the hard stuff in the background. And I think the kernel doing all of the hard, cool stuff for you to improve performance, that's really probably difficult for someone like me to implement, but it's very beneficial for the people who do know how to implement these things. Also multi-user. Multi-user processes are multi-user systems. That's what page memory is good for. So hypothetically, you have multiple users logged in at the same time. Someone's not using their web browser. That gets swapped out. And it doesn't stall any single one user's login session, because parts are coming into memory off of disk and being sent to disk off of memory back and forth fast enough where you don't even really realize that arbitrary parts of your program are being swapped in and out constantly. So I have two parts for programming interface. The other one will come later. So the first part is sort of system calls, kernel modules, and drivers. So system calls improve security and make programming a lot easier. So instead of your program directly asking for memory or for network access or for disk access, instead the program says, "Hey kernel, am I allowed to access or give me access to this file?" And the kernel says no, or the kernel says, "Sure, here you go." And also, this means we don't have to write assembly to access files, because these things have been abstracted. All of the hard parts are done for us, and forcing some of these more, I guess, dangerous or potential for danger system calls to go through the kernel adds a layer of protection. Your web browser doesn't need access to all of the memory, because that means your web browser can read your disk encryption keys that are stored in memory. Instead, the web browser should say, "Hey, kernel, give me memory," instead of just taking memory without getting permission from the arbiter of all. And then kernel modules, I think of them as like dynamic extensions, as kind of plug and play, except sometimes not, and it crashes everything. So kernel modules, it's a thing you can load into the kernel. It gives your kernel extra capabilities, sometimes file system support or hardware support. And the idea behind kernel modules is it's a component of the kernel that's not directly compiled into the kernel, but is dynamically loaded and unloaded when needed. Sometimes kernel modules are a pain, especially when they don't load when you need them to. But the benefit behind kernel modules is that whenever, say, there's a bug in your mouse driver or your Wi-Fi driver, instead of having to recompile a kernel, install that kernel, and then reboot into that new kernel, you can just update your Wi-Fi driver kernel module, unload, reload, and now you have a new kernel module without the bug. Some people call these drivers, I call them KMODs or kernel modules, because that's what they are. It's a module of the kernel, and what it performs is arbitrary. It's not actually, it doesn't actually have to be a driver all the time. So the next thing is the file system. So Unix, sometimes I think of Unix as sort of, it's not really anything but a hierarchical file structure that became a monstrosity. Because if everything is a file, doesn't that just mean Unix is a file system? So unlike a disk operating system, or something that's claiming to not be a disk operating system, but is still a disk-based operating system, the Unix file system is hierarchical. Because of virtual file systems, which are logical file systems. What this means is that instead of having like an A drive, a B drive, a C drive, and a D drive, and continuing all the way till Z when you run out of letters, and now you can't mount any more drives, and now you're struggling because you can't mount any more drives, even though you have the interfaces to mount past the Z drive. You can use virtual file systems to sort of get around this constraint of I guess, lettering drives. So virtual file systems, multiple disks are presented to the user as a single unified file system. This is completely ignoring what actual type of file system is on that drive. So local disks, NFS shares the contents of your CD-ROM. Depending on how you mount it, the storage on your cell phone when you plug it in, it's all presented as one big drive because mount points are entirely arbitrary. You can put whatever file system, whatever disk you want, wherever you want in the file system. You can mount it wherever, and it's just one big file system. One big hard drive. You don't have to think really hard about where things are. You don't have to change disks. All you have to do is think, you know, I'm going to mount this to this subdirectory, and now it's just part of the file system. It's part of the one big hard drive, and I don't have to worry. I don't have to think. I don't have to change how my programs run or change hard-coded values. I just type mount, disk, whatever here, and then it just mounts there. Another interesting thing is bind mounts. So a bind mount is when you mount a directory to another directory. And this idea, I haven't found any practical application for bind mounts, but it's kind of interesting. So this means, hypothetically, you plug in a drive. Of course, you have to mount it as root. But say you want to read it as a normal user, you can bind mount that directory to like /home, your user, CD-ROM, or whatever it is. And bind mounts are really interesting because the entire file system, right, virtual file system, it's so flexible. You can think of it as one large file system where you can put anything anywhere, and there's not really any restrictions, and it's completely, I guess, ignorant, right? The kernel's or what the kernel presents to you. Allows the end user to be completely ignorant of what disks are where, which I think is a really useful thing. And I use this concept quite a lot when I mount a remote system over SSH or FTP or however I mount it. I typically put that in like /home/my user/remote. And because it's not a hard-coded value and it's not in my FS tab, I can put whatever I want in that remote directory, whatever computer I'm remotely connecting to, I can just put it right in that directory, the home/remote directory. Similarly, you know, home/disk. This is what I have, and every time I plug in a disk, I'll just mount it there. So I don't have to adjust my muscle memory every time. I just plug it in, and I don't even think about it. And I think it really makes it easy for a user to be able to use virtual file systems. The last thing I'm going to say about virtual file systems is the idea of a RAM disk. So a RAM disk, remember how I said you can use a hard drive for RAM, kind of, using swap space? A RAM disk is the opposite. You're using a portion of your RAM as a piece of physical storage. And you mount that presented as any other device, any other directory. That's how it's presented to the end user. Again, shoot foot here. We all know RAM disks are, sometimes a bad idea. Like I said before, in Unix, everything is a file. To elaborate on this idea, not everything is actually a file, but everything is presented to the user and the programmer as a file. So the big example is that devurandom is the random entropy generator. It's presented as a file. So when you're a Unix programmer, how do you get a secure random number? You read some bytes from DeviRandom, and now you have a securely seeded random number generator. Another example is that the kernel translates mouse input into a data stream. That data stream is presented as a file, so when the programmer's writing a graphical user interface, instead of having to also include a mouse driver into their program, you just read input from DeviRandom, and it's just a data stream. So my first exercise is to cat on Linux. If you're running Linux, type sudo cat /dev/input/mouse0, and then wiggle your mouse. There's the data stream. You can run it through a hex dump if you want to see what it's really doing. On FreeBSD, it's cat /dev/sysmouse, and of course this is going to change depending on what hardware you're running, but I think those are the two most common. Another example, the TTY, the virtual terminals, the ones you can get to when you push like Control-Alt-F3, that's just a file, and you can actually print this file using the setterm command. So my example here, I have these examples in the show notes, or I guess the second exercise here, right? Use the setterm to dump the contents of a TTY because everything is a file. Right, just sudo setterm --dump and then the number of the TTY. In my example, I did TTY3, and you just print the contents of the file. Wow, the terminal is actually just the file. And although these things seem kind of like hacks, when you think about from a scripting perspective or from a programming perspective, presenting everything as either a file or a process or a socket, which is kind of like a file, it really simplifies programming, because really every single program you write basically just reads files and writes to files. It reads a file, does some logic, and then writes to a file, and that's all you have to think about when you're programming. Even a pipe is a file, but I'll get to that. So linking. So sometimes when I think of how to make links, this is like hard links and symbolic links. I think of linking like mounting a directory to another directory, but without actually using a bind mount, so it's accessible in both places. So there are two types of links, hard links and short links. Hard links adds a new index to a file, so the file has the exact same inode. And when you add a hard link, basically you're saying, file A and file B are pointers to the exact same file. So if I delete file A, file B still points to the file that was also pointed by file A before I remove file A. Different name, same file. Symlinks are actually like pointers, because once the original file is gone, the symlink breaks. But a symlink, when you say, tell your text editor to open a symlink, you say, hey, open ./symlink to whatever. The whatever file just opens. Because a symlink, when you try to open it, says, hey, actually the file you want is this other file. I'm just telling you where this other file is. And I think using, I don't really use hard links, but using symlinks makes it really convenient to access files in places you normally wouldn't access them, and also to, pass like your MariaDB sockets or your PHP processing sockets into a chroot that otherwise would be kind of difficult to do. Things like that. File extensions. This is one of my favorite, I guess, the most mischievous aspects about a Unix system is that file extensions are entirely arbitrary. Because the guys who wrote all of our Unix-y tools, instead of reading file name extensions, what they did is they said, hey, the file tells us exactly what kind of file it is. Why do we have to care about extensions? the file system doesn't break when the extension doesn't match what you're expecting. Your programs don't crash when you throw it a file that doesn't have the, I guess, in Windows world, correct file extension. I always tell people, you know, why are you sending me a text file with a .txt when we're both using Unix systems? You know, why do you have to put a .txt on everything? I can see that it's a text file just by typing file using the file command. So I always say extensions only matter when you willfully associate with Microsoft users. And the types of people who leave issues on your software repository saying, like, this doesn't work. In sort of my hypothetical response to those types of people, it's like, it's not my operating system, so it's not my issue. And also, all of the code I'm writing is open source, so you can fork it if you don't like it and add file extensions. But for myself, really the only time I use file extensions is when I'm publishing something on the web, or when I'm trying to coerce a specific code forge, I think is the right word, a specific code server to add syntax highlighting to the thing instead of just treat it like plain text. So back to multi-user, the concept of a time-sharing operating system. So multitasking that enables a multi-user system, right? That's the round robin. Each user gets put in a queue for system resources. And my exercise here is sort of attempt to use a Microsoft operating system like a multi-user system. I think they're now claiming that Windows is a multi-user operating system, but it doesn't have discretionary access control. You know, it's not multiple users concurrently. You can't really set up, I guess technically there are services, but you know, the running is typically not a service account. And I think, you know, if you try to use a Windows system like a multi-user operating system, a true multi-user operating system, you can't, you know, it's all advertising. Multi-user means multi-user, not we're presenting you a login interface that allows you to change your user, but really it's all running basically as an admin account with de-escalated permissions. It's a little bit ridiculous, and I have encountered some issues with like multi-user type stuff when I've had the misfortune of having to touch a Windows computer. The big one is discretionary access control. The fact that you can't really do discretionary access control at all, that's not viable for a multi-user operating system. You might have multiple users, but it's like plugging in, you know, 20 screens and 20 keyboards into the same thing and everyone trying to get stuff done. It's really chaotic, and you can't prevent so-and-so from removing your files that you put on the network share. And you can't prevent so-and-so from filling your files with garbage data that you have to put on the network share. It's kind of a pain, especially when you have sysadmins and network admins who don't care that people are causing chaos and sort of slowing productivity. Users in groups. This is something that I think is really, really beneficial, is that every user is a user, but every user can also be part of a group. So that way we can assign permissions to an entire group and users inherit those permissions. We can, you know, set, I guess, priority rate for the CPU time or how much memory a person's allowed to use. We can set that for the entire group. Similarly, file system access. And it really speeds things up when you need to, for example, you have to grant the accounting department some files. So you just grant the accounting group read-write access. But the HR department doesn't need write access to the accounting stuff, so they only get read access, right? It's sort of that idea, you know, the classic example. And if you're using FreeBSD, the RCTL program allows you to create login classes and also give like hard resource allocations. Or I guess hard resource limits to specific users and groups. So what this means is that you can set a limit to where a normal user can't use more than, say, 20% of the system memory so that the user doesn't crash the system. In a similar vein to users, are system daemons or services. So since every process has to be owned by an owner, a service is also owned by an owner. And this allows us to set permissions on the service in the exact same way we set permissions on the user. It's really clever how in Unix land we do pretty much everything the same for everything. And we don't really have to think too hard. You know, if we learn about, managing a login user account, guess what? We also now know how to manage a system user account. And the idea behind putting, your web server and your DNS server, running them under a non-root account, right, a daemon account, is that you're not running a web server as root user, which means if the thing is exploited, only that system account is exploited, and that system account doesn't really have access to a whole lot, only exactly what you give it, or exactly what your distribution maintainers give it. And that means someone can take over your web server and not get remote code execution necessarily, although it is possible. Another thing, I talked about access control previously, I mentioned it, but since Unix is designed to be a multi-user system, access control is absolutely necessary. So access control means assigning permissions to people. It's controlling access. That's what it means. So access control, you can use the octals. I just remember RWX. That's read, write, execute flags. Whoever owns the file can grant those flags. Systems administrator can grant those permissions. And the order is owner, group, and other. Or UGOA, right? User, group, other, all. This is something that you just get in the habit of knowing when you use Chmod a lot. This is discretionary access control. It means you can modify files at your own discretion. So this means, for example, you want people to be able to read your hypothetically Vim configuration, right? The other users on your network to read your Vim configuration so they can learn from it. But you don't want them to write to it. You grant the, you're in the user group, right? The users group. You grant the group read permissions on your like home.vimrc. So other people can read your Vim configuration but not write to it. But also you could make it so they could write to it or execute it. There are problems with discretionary access control. But typically most people don't change those things. You kind of have to be thinking, I want to share this with a person. They already have a shell, let's just change permissions. Most people don't think that way. Most people think, how do I send you this file? I instead think, how do I grant you permission to view this file? Okay, now actually using the thing, this is the second part of my programming interface. So all Unix utilities, at least the ones that I think are worth using, they have three data streams, standard in, standard out, standard error. When you're writing a program, you read from standard in the same way you read from a file. When you're writing to standard out, you print to the same way you write to a file, or you write to the terminal, which is just a file. Standard error, you print the exact same way you write to a file, and you read from standard error the exact same way you read from a file. Everything is files, right? Even inter-process communication. The way that it's implemented in the standard libraries is just files. So when you think about, file input output, it's really just file input output. When you think about inter-process communication, not in a socket sense, but in a Unix pipe sense, passing data through a series of filters, it makes it really easy to program for. You know, I don't have to think really hard about, how am I going to get input from a different program? No, I just read from standard in. And if there's nothing coming from standard in, set a flag that doesn't take standard input into consideration when calculating results. Similarly, I guess not similarly, but there's also a fourth data stream, kind of. It's environmental variables. That's how CGI programs pass data around, using environmental variables to push data around. It's kind of a hack, but that's one of the cool things about Unix is all of these accidental hacks, these things that were created by accident, flexibility. It allows you, the end user, the programmer, to think of a creative solution to a problem, but without really not thinking that hard. So for example, you know, if you didn't know about environmental variables, you would just probably pass formatted text, you know, comma delimited or using like the IFS variable or what have you. But if you didn't know about file input-output, you think, oh, I know about environmental variables, let's pass data through environmental variables. There's all sorts of weird but clever ways to do things, and sort of the ability to achieve the same result in an infinite number or I guess it's kind of like when you do math, you can sort of change the function into something that gives you the same result as all of the other possible permutations of the function. This is permutation, not in the math sense, but in like variant. It'll give you the exact same result. You can do this with Unix too. You can put any string of commands you want and get the exact same result that you want. But you can also do it a completely different way, and someone will do it this way, and someone will do it that way. And it's really, instead of, you know, memorizing sort of a context menu hell, you just think, what is the result that I want, and how do I walk backwards from that result? And there's not really a whole lot of, I guess, memorization of answers. It's more so, I have this mental algorithm to achieve a result. What are the puzzle pieces I know to get the result? And I think that's one of my favorite parts about using Unix, is that there is no set function to get to the desired answer. It's just, what do you want? And here's a toolbox, figure out how to get there. How do we do these things? With the shell. So the shell is actually what you interact with when you use a Unix system. I always say that the shell is sort of a human computer interface using human language. And whenever someone's like, I can't figure out how to use a terminal, I tell them, it's literally just human language interface with the computer. You know how to talk to your, like, Amazon wiretap that you put in your house. You know what words to tell it to give you what the result that you want. Using a command line is no different, except that no one is spying on you when you're using a command line. And I think, you know, explicitly telling the computer exactly what to do, it's a lot less painful than trying to interact with the computer that interprets user input and tries to do what the user intends rather than what the user explicitly says, especially when these interfaces that translate explicit instructions into what does the user mean, not what does the user say, they all seem really over-engineered and poorly designed, and they're very inconsistent. They always give you a different thing every time, depending on, of course, interface implementation. The other thing that I really like about using the Unix shell, this would be like bash, POSIX shell, corn shell, right? That's what the shell is. That's what the sh stands for in all of them. The shell is a scriptable interface. So math is kind of difficult to do in POSIX shell scripting. But most of the time you're doing math in a different math-specific language, because the shell is for human language. Numbers are kind of somewhere in between human language and computer language. But most of the things you can accomplish are with just strings. And I think this again goes back to the toolbox full of puzzle pieces to get to an answer, is that you can put things in the pipe in whatever order you want and get probably the exact same result if you're shooting for a specific result. And I think one of my favorite interesting thoughts I've had about the POSIX shell is that the POSIX shell is strongly typed and statically typed, because the only data type is a string. You have one data type string, so therefore it is strongly typed. It is statically typed. And of course, there are problems, right? When you only have one data type string, you have problems doing math. Case in point, JavaScript. But this sort of idea that hey, let's write something super simple where the only data type is string, it's almost magical that we can actually do math in shell when the only data type is string. And I guess my last point to the shell is that if there's a shell utility we don't have to accomplish our goal, or we need a math function, or, you know, a purpose-specific, what's the correct term for it? An application-specific solution, we can just write a simple shell program or a simple C program that fits into our shell pipeline, and it's entirely trivial to do to add a new filter, I guess, to our existing shell script, which is really just the form of metaprogramming. And I think the last concept is the concept of piping. I mentioned this. But the Unix philosophy, right? Everything is a file, and programs will transfer data to other programs in the concept or in the format of a data stream, right? Plain text. The pipe character, this is the Legos. This is building blocks for shell metaprogramming. It makes things really easy because each program is basically a filter, right? That's another Unix idea I don't think I wrote down. Write shell programs that are basically filters for other programs. A lot of people, I guess maybe in the olden days, you would just use awk. But I prefer shell. I prefer taking these tools that I use all the time for like one-off problems to solve and combining them into something larger, something monstrous. Let's see. I'm not sure if I said why Unix is sublime. This really just turned out to be all the reasons I like Unix and sort of a 1,000-foot view of the operating system. So I'll use my bonus ones. So the bonus, right? Everything in Unix is a plain text configuration file unless you're using systemd. The fact that everything is configurable in plain text, although it's not the same format, it makes it really easy to copy settings from specific things, programs on different systems back and forth. There is no registry editing hellscape. Pretty much all the log files are just a CSV, except the comma is usually not the delimiter. This is one that the reason why people use Linux is that the operating system vendor doesn't force you to upgrade to a newer version of spyware. Whenever the new version of spyware comes out, you can choose not to upgrade, right? You, as the systems administrator, which you are if you're running a Unix system or a Linux system on a personal computer, you are the systems administrator. You get to choose modular design. I really like the modular design of Unix. If you think back to all of the things that I said, really it seems like modularity is an operating system goal. You know, virtual memory, you can put memory however you want it, wherever you want it. You can use any storage device as memory. Virtual file system, you can put anything you want that is capable of storing data as presented to the user as a hard disk. When everything is basically a file, we can interact with non-file hardware devices, if you will, as if they are a file. You know, users and groups and services. You can make your own custom daemon account. The exact same way you write a normal user account, you write the configuration for that normal user account. You know, shell scripting, that is the essence of flexibility that we see from a user's perspective, but not exclusively a systems administrator perspective or an implementation perspective. And also what this modular design means is that the entire infrastructure for your IT department doesn't go down when Explorer.exe crashes, right? If your GNOME shell crashes, the system keeps running as the kernel restarts the GDM process. And I think the one thing that I kind of failed to mention at the beginning is portable design. So let's circle back. You know, Unix, the boys at Bell Labs, they made something smaller, less complicated, easier to use, with the goal of portability. This is really write once, run everywhere, even though you do have to do some porting sometimes. Unix really is the common interface between various architectures. And that's because, you know, Unix is kind of the, or as I've said before, POSIX is the lowest common denominator. So if you target POSIX, your code runs everywhere you can think of. And that's because no one's porting Windows to RISC. No one's porting, you know, Windows to like a VAX emulator. Everyone's porting Unix to RISC. Everyone's porting Unix to the VAX. You know, these types of ideas. So I think my summary here is that at the end of it all, really, Unix is basically a simple operating system, but it's really a non-simple operating system. It's designed for, you know, 1970s mainframes, but it's the least bad thing we have. You know, a lot of these things don't seem to make a lot of sense. A lot of the Unix concepts are kind of like hacks. But these hacks are what make it so endearing, I think. You know, Unix is big, comparing it to like a hobbyist operating system. Unix is massive, even like a minimal, I guess, non-systemd system, you know, something built with BusyBox or Muscle Libc, you know, something that's a Linux plus GNU or even a BSD system. All of these hobbyist operating systems are much smaller, but that's because they tend to be written for one specific goal as opposed to Unix, which is general purpose, you know. Write once, run everywhere, for any purpose. I think that's something I'm going to start saying. And I think compared to commercial operating systems, Unix can be as small or as big as you want, but typically, I think, or at least in a lot of the forums I have read in the past, sort of the goal of Unix, you know, sort of a challenge of these Unix users is to assemble the most minimal operating system they can, because they can do it. And I think Unix is more than a minimum viable operating system. But that doesn't mean we can't turn it into a sort of a maximum viable operating system, you know, something too big and unwieldy, just barely able to wield it. Or we can make it minimum viable. That's the flexibility. Do what you want with it. That's the design, is to be flexible. And I think my final link before I stop and edit the show is my see also the Unix Haters Handbook. You know, worse is better. And I think maybe Unix is Sublime is the wrong title. But I sort of started writing and I said, what are the reasons I like Unix? What are the coolest things about you know, POSIX likes? It's the fact that they're all familiar and there's a lot of clever things, you know, worse is better solutions that make it quite pleasant to use. And anyway, thanks for listening. Hopefully check out some of these links. If anyone knows a lot about Multics, I would be interested in listening to something about Multics. Similarly, if anyone knows a whole lot about Minix. That would be something I'm interested in. Sort of all I know about Minix is that Mr. Tenenbaum didn't want to pay for a Unix license, so he invented Minix. And then Mr. Torvalds didn't want to pay for a Minix license, so he invented Linux. And that is the entire history of free software in a nutshell. People didn't want to pay a license, but they liked the idea, so they just implemented it themselves. So if you know about Multics, I guess that's my show request. If you know about Minix, that's all another show request. As for traditional Unix, I think, you know, cool but useless. You know, the Unix, the Bell Labs Unix, cool but useless. So again, thanks for listening. And now it's time for me to start thinking about the next show.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.